Today, gangs are like, you're buying a furnished apartment or renting, buying a furnished apartment, but you're not allowed to move your furniture elsewhere when you buy it, when you go to a new apartment. Yes. That's how gangs are today. Yes. So the value of that apartment is less as compared to when you can actually move your furniture.
Mm.
We live in like a global economy where countries do not trade. So every country has to like dig their own oil, do their own manufacturing, build their own autos, do the transport, everything, and not trade. So
next level.
Next level on the ABXY podcast with Ziad, with Vincent Rousseau. Vince is the founder and CEO of Nifty Craft. In this episode, we'll learn more about Vince's journey, why he chose gaming, why he started, when he started, and where he started, and learn more about his insights, specifically in comparison between the MENA market and the Chinese market, as well as the projects that they are currently working on. Vince, I'm so happy to have you. Please, let's start by introducing yourself.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm Vincent Gosu, CEO and founder of Nifty Craft. We're building a game with a title that's not very inventive. It's called The World of Nifty Craft. It's a mashup between deck builder and MMO. So the core is a deck builder wrapped by an MMO experience. 2D, joyful. It's, you know, our playtest attracted quite a good proportion of females, actually. Though male is still dominant, like most MMOs. It'll be an open beta this June. And full as soon as possible after that, hopefully by August. And we'll use that game as a platform for interoperability with other games later on.
So it's a blockchain-based game.
To do that, you are likely going to need the blockchain.
Okay.
Not always, but it's possible. Very possible.
Yeah, okay, cool. Okay, cool. We'll dive more into that later. I'm interested to hear your story about how did you start in gaming first and why did you choose gaming in the first place?
So there's one. I started gaming ever since I can hold a controller. I was 3 years old, yeah. But that did not get me started in the business of gaming. Ever since I'm a kid, you know, when I used to play games, I always wondered, like, how does this character on a screen jump around and move and gets animated? And you know, like when you are a kid, you have these fantasies. Is someone hiding in that TV box and presenting to me the news? Or like so I always had those like weird curiosities about how this is done. But for a long time, I didn't go further than that. In fact, I had a hiatus away from game when most people game a lot, and it was during university. I was more into like
business.
Football.
Ah, and, okay.
Yeah. I should say studies too. But then I picked up after university again.
Where did you study, by the way?
My bachelor was at the American University of Beirut, AUB.
Okay. Yeah. What did you major at?
CCE. Computer Communications Engineering.
Okay.
So, I mean, you know, jumping fast forward, I was doing an MBA in China, and it was like 2007, the early days of freemium.
Yeah.
And Asia was leading the way in freemium, and I come from the Middle East, and I had noticed, in fact, quite counterintuitively that user behavior in China and the Middle East were very similar, bar the language. They were very similar, very competitive nature, very social nature. These aspects are very pronounced in the MENA player, but also in the Chinese player, at least back then. And also both regions had a lot of piracy. So free-to-play, online, social, multiplayer, browser-based, no need for downloads. It just fits all the features of the
text environments.
Yeah. Yeah, of both places, you know. Piracy was rampant, download speeds were slow, so you had to be on the browser online without downloading, and you had to be free, so you kill piracy, no need for download, no need for piracy, and you make games that are social. So both you know, regions were very similar that way, except that China had a lot of content and good teams. The MENA back then was like, well, quite empty.
Yeah.
So it was a no-brainer to make, you know, to, you know, look at best practices, hire talent in China, and make games for Arabic speakers. That's my first studio, Falafel Games.
Yeah, but before Falafel, like during your MBA,
yeah.
At that time, what was your day-to-day like? What did you work?
Ah, okay. In technology. Ah, so, okay. Yeah. I were a few, you know, like some...
So
just before going to my MBA, I was working with a company based in Cleveland, of all places.
Okay.
Yeah. That was sort of like a holding with a few startups underneath it in doing like telco and telecommunications technologies, location-based stuff. Back then, that's like 20 years ago. You know, messaging, location-based, security for the phone. It was still feature phones. There was a lot of activity around that. And so my job was like to interface between commercial and technical across their portfolio. So they would have me jump from team to team and across, you know, we'll just work. But I didn't know what I was, you know, I was just like very junior. It seems that this interface between those two departments is... I don't know. It's like rare to find. And I had like...
It's what a product manager does today.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes, but I wasn't even at the level of the product manager. I had to explain to the techies what the product manager meant. And to the product manager what the techies meant. And I got into that job actually after finding one of the... I didn't start with that holding in Cleveland. I had started with one of their startups that was based in Beirut when I graduated, which was doing... disaster continuity. It's
back in 2005?
That's like 2004.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was in tech. I was playing games, strategy games mainly. I really, you know, I was mostly on the telco side. I hadn't thought about games and the business of games much until I saw that realization of the Asian...
Similarities between the markets.
Similarities and the the wave of freemium and free to play. I was very curious about how it worked. I thought it was extremely interesting. Had it not happened then, maybe I would have never been in games, like, you know, just doing boxed games and premium games. That was
the
model back then. It like meant nothing to me. So the model of free to play. So live services attracted me so much, and I learned about it. And the more I learned about it, the more I loved it.
Just to explain what free to play back then meant, can you give me like a famous game that hit at the time that was a free to play live servicing game on the web? Like, is it like miniclip type of games or different types of games?
So definitely the miniclip types of games are free to play back then. You know, like the portals with little games, but the games I'm talking about are the browser-based MMOs.
Yeah.
So it's much larger. Each one would have its own dedicated domain, its own dedicated live ops support, and that's where the community lived. And when we started, it was web game. It was on the browser because we did not want players to bother with download speeds.
Interesting.
That's 2010.
Yeah, so this is Falafel Games.
That's right.
You started the studio in China.
Yes.
And your team was based in China.
Right.
Cool. Okay, tell me more about Falafel.
So the team was based in China. We had to do content for Arabic speakers. So
in China? Or
I was in China. So we needed people who could create content for Arabic speakers. So we had to import, you know, Arabic speakers and content creators.
From the Middle East.
Exactly. They wanted, some of them still work with me today. It was hard enough to work with Chinese and hard enough to work with Arabs, and then I had to work with both and make them work together
between the two, like your old job.
And exactly, yeah. It was a great journey for me personally, like development. I learned Chinese that way, Mandarin. I had to.
How much time did you spend in China?
11 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so you had to learn the language.
Yeah, so we were in it's quite a developed city, but in China, it's still called a tier two city, Hangzhou, which is home to Alibaba. And like, literally no one on my team spoke any English.
Wow.
Yeah. So I, you know, though I had taken an MBA program before that.
You had to speak Chinese during your MBA program?
It was an international.
Ah, okay.
So the education language was English.
Yeah.
So it was a soft landing, and it's in Shanghai, more international city, more people spoke English there. But like the real crash course to, you know, learn the jolt to the system to like have to learn Chinese, Mandarin, was when I went to Hangzhou to start Falafel Games.
Why did you go to Hangzhou? Like, you went
to Shanghai. I found my first team. So, you know, in gaming, you need a whole set of skill sets.
Yeah.
A whole chain of skill sets to make something. Otherwise, you cannot make 99% of a game.
That's yeah.
Missing its art. You know, you end up with nothing. So you need the game design, the engineering, the art, the management to glue it all together, the planning, the finance, the business. Well, at least on the production side, you still need many skills, right? Working together. And it's hard to get started with one skill and not the other. And I was really lucky to find like a small cell of really talented people who were in Hangzhou. And back then I was ready to like change city. And I thought Hangzhou was a great place. In China, it's called like a heaven under the clouds. It's okay. In tourism, it's second to Beijing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it was a good place to be.
Interesting. And did you manage to find these, like this cell of a team that you're telling
me? Yeah. Luck, man.
How does it work over there?
I guess when you grind enough, you get lucky.
Yeah, yeah. Like,
so
make your own luck, actually.
Yeah, like, kind of. By showing up.
Yeah.
Yeah, so actually a friend of mine introduced me. He's like, hey, there's this development. It was a studio that developed games based in Hangzhou, who was willing to partner up with me based on the concept of making games for Arabic speakers and carve out a full cell, a full team for me to work with. So I worked with them before, like, committing much more, you know, getting to know them. It's one of the best teams I ever met.
Yeah.
It just felt, back then, I didn't realize. In hindsight,
yeah, yeah,
I thought I'm so lucky.
Yeah. Yeah. And what did you guys build?
So our first game, we looked at the hottest web game in China and copycatted it. We copycatted the so-called copycat.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was quite an original game. It was very well thought out, and it wasn't a copycat. But, you know, China had this back then, no more, doesn't have this perception anymore. But back then, it had the perception of being a copycat. And true, there was a lot of copycatting happening in China. But the game, it was called Ao Shi Tian Di. They reskinned it in English. I cannot remember the English.
That was after you did it in Arabic?
Yeah, after. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So we looked at the Chinese game. It's a great, it's the kind of like, it's the genre that I would play, but that I also believed was good for business. It was a strategy RPG, browser-based. So the browser was not so powerful there. So you needed largely static graphics with a little animation, not too heavy on the system, on the memory and all that. And obviously, you know, in China, back then, having not great speeds and internet speeds, they also thought about matching the genre with the environment.
Yeah.
So it was a strategy RPG game, but the skin was its theme was the Three Kingdoms. Surprise, surprise!
Okay.
Most Chinese games back then were themed the Three Kingdoms because there's a huge wealth of interesting culture, stories and content around the Three Kingdoms, and it's quite romanticized. Of course, we couldn't make the Three Kingdoms for Arabic speakers, so we did the Arab Conquest. That's how.
Mm.
So we copied the way it played, the mechanic. We had to figure out the balancing. There's a lot of unknowns. the tuning, all of that, the systems, how they interact together. And then we skinned it with an Arab conquest theme. And over time, we started learning really the levers of monetization.
This is 2010, 2011?
So that game launched in 2012.
2012, was it?
That's when it
web
launched.
It was web, right?
It was web.
2013, we did.
So 2013,
yeah.
We're old. 2013, we thought, let's do an experiment on the iPhone.
Hmm.
So back then, for a game, it's a strategy, RPG, MMO, very complex.
What engine did you use for that at that time?
Flash ActionScript.
Yeah. Okay. And for
it was not bad. It was a good...
For the iPhone?
So, no, we did native.
Oh, okay.
We went to iPhone. So we wanted to do it as an experiment. And we were not... I personally was not a big believer. I was wrong. But back then, I could justify it. In mid-core games, being ported to mobile, you know, the big games then were... Candy Crush had just come out. The poster boy was
Angry Birds. But wasn't Clash of Clans at the time?
Clash of Clans was surfacing. Mm. And it was the most mid... But we were way more mid-core than...
More core
than Clash of Clans. So just to like make the experiment, we just shrunk the screen onto like the mobile phone. We did not think of like mobile UX. Just shrink it onto... It was like a really, you know, like little small fonts and a lot of buttons everywhere. But it worked. It did very good returns, to the point that we regretted not making it properly.
Yeah.
We took our lessons and we became mobile.
How was it monetized on the iPhone in 2013?
Same. You had the IAPs on the iPhone
since
a while ago. Were like 4 years before 2013 available, I think. From the first or second year of the iPhone, maybe version 2 or something.
Nice. It was a premium game or was it
premium?
Oh, premium.
And back then you still had those gimmicks of marketing where you would first put it for $1.99 on
then
the store.
Luck more,
then turn it free. And when you turn it free, you get an uplift. It bounces you in terms of like... So when it's paid, you know, it's getting pressure. It's getting pent-up demand. And poof, you unlock it for free and then demand comes. So that was... Now these things are like so outdated to use. That actually, there's no way to do any gimmick on...
I don't think it's ethical anyway. Like today, if I buy a product and then it goes for free.
Yeah.
You know what?
Yeah, maybe you get... But anyways, you get no downloads if it's paid. You get no downloads if it's free. The only way to get downloads is to buy downloads.
Yeah. Yeah. How did you market
on mobile,
by the way, during that time?
On the web or on the...
I mean, web and iPhone.
Well, performance marketing also.
Normal.
Yeah. But the big duopoly hadn't been established very well.
Yeah.
In fact, Facebook was still coming up with a lot of new ad products.
Facebook games were a thing back then, right?
That's true. Facebook games. So before mobile just dominated everything. When it was still viable to be on the browser. Still viable, but I think there may be a resurgence of browsers.
Yeah, I'm seeing this.
But back then, you know, browser had a role to play. Facebook games was a player in the browser space. We just did not want to deal with the Facebook games and with their monetization and that, like the payment system.
Free, I think. Free games mostly.
Yeah, free, of course. But I mean, the way you pay, the way you top up
Facebook.
And I thought, no, but my main theory then was that our games, I just loved our game. They were just so large and so committal in terms of time and in terms of interacting with the community that we just had a hypothesis that it just doesn't fit the casual. For us, Facebook was for casual. Though you had like strategy games, you had RPG games on Facebook, and I think many did well. But we just had that hypothesis. And eventually Facebook, they decided to fold on their own.
Yeah.
that business. They never liked games, and they don't like games, and they just want to extract value.
They want to benefit from games.
By being gatekeeper for the App Store, yeah. They figured that that may be a better model for them than having to decide which game will make the most money and take a piece of it. Maybe they thought, let you know, all the game publishers bid for placements. So this way is a more of an organic, natural way to get the most budget from the most profitable games without asking them for
share. Interesting. I just want to mention that web games are resurfacing due to cloud gaming.
Really?
Yeah. I've seen a few examples that are crazy good. Like normal Unity-based games exported into web, cloud web. You just follow the link and then you start playing. Performance is similar to that of mobile.
Yeah. I don't know what's the case for cloud. It's as a cloud. I just feel
mobile. Mobile, like...
I mean, why would you want to stream it from the cloud and not run it on the edge?
To avoid gatekeepers. So, for example, if we're talking, blockchain games, now you can follow a link, you can play the game, you avoid Apple and Google, and then you can...
Yeah, it's like a new experience on Roblox. Roblox is streamed, I think. So a new experience on Roblox, you don't need the blessing of Apple's review and things like that. That's what you mean. Yeah. No, but I feel there is a resurgence. There will be a resurgence of browser games. Well, there's the Web3 part, but forget it. Like,
not even Web3, even
the mainstream. Because there are
or real money gaming
play games on the browser. They exist. We just neglected them for a very long time.
Yeah.
We all heard it and went towards mobile. And mobile ate the browser market. But actually, there are people who want a game on browser.
Even with Apple, by the way, they have now their games with the M chip. You can play their games, like download games on your MacBook.
Mm-hmm.
It's to cater for the light casual PC gamer or like laptop gamer, you know. Now you can, like if you have a game today on iOS, it can be downloaded on your Mac. It can be played with your mouse.
Okay.
It's for the casual,
crossplay.
Not really. It's single player games even. Like our game is on. You can play it on your
Mac. For crossplay, to play on both. Like at work, you play on your platform.
Exactly.
On
this is for the for those web gamers also.
Yeah.
It caters for that.
But this you don't actually download it on the laptop on the Mac.
Yeah, you have to.
You don't play it on Safari.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think there is an audience of people who just want to play with Safari,
browser based.
And what's wrong with the browser? And now the browser can run anything.
Yeah, it's so powerful. Interesting.
I'm not advocating this, but I think this is something I definitely should look into.
I'm looking into the web, the browser cloud gaming.
Yeah.
I'm looking into it. I'm interested to know. I don't know what could be or what could happen, but it's interesting. It's a new genre.
Yeah, we're all now in a phase where so many platforms are so saturated. Growth is slowing. That we're looking for like new emerging platforms, TikTok's live stream games, VR, blockchain, cloud. They're all very timely.
Yeah, even but mobile.
We need like a paradigm, a change in trend.
New monetization models on mobile. Some people are trying to find.
Yeah, like web stores.
Like the normal. Mostly payment and ads and you know. Hybrid casual and these types of games. Okay, so Falafel, you made the first game.
Yeah.
It was a success. What did success mean at the time?
I don't know if it was a success. So that first game is a game where Falafel is most famous for because it was themed the Arab Conquest and it was our maiden title. Arab Conquest is probably a very, let's say, intriguing, interesting, exciting topic. And MENA, especially that it can be sometimes sensitive depending on if you put entourage of the Prophet, you don't put entourage of the Prophet in the game. And it was, we had to manage to navigate these sensitivities. So that's why, you know, a lot of people in the industry know us for that game. It had about 1.6 million users. So, okay.
It's actually back in 2013. That's a great number.
Yeah, from no, overall, from like the, when it's, I think in the first 2 years it reached that. Then I lost count. And made a couple $1 million. So in terms of LTV, it was not great. Because we learned the monetization on the way. But our follow-on games, which were much more successful, we'd learned the playbook, we'd learned the performance marketing playbook, we'd created some stuff. We were some of the first ones to use, by the way, KOLs, influencers, when they were just kids who never had any advertisers and we had to like speak their language, convince them to, you know, do a post about our game because it fits their audience for, and they would like not believe that we're offering them $500 to do it, and we'd get like 100,000 downloads from that $500. So we were some of the first ones doing that. We also learned the playbook of monetizing. So the following games were much better in terms of LTV, but we were not as known for them as for Sandalmajd in Arabic, or Knights with a K of Glory, because it was just like that Arab conquest topic, and it was the first. Yeah. First.
By the way, I remember you once told me about a story where you were at the airport, I think in Amman, Jordan.
Yeah. Here in Dubai.
Ah, in Dubai.
Yeah.
Can you just like...
When he asked me what I do, and I told him I make games, like, you know, like for Sandalmajd, that's the game I made. Yeah, I made it. It's like at passport control.
Yeah, it was at passport control.
It was great. I even asked him for his account, and I told him you sent him some of my credits.
It's nice to actually see your creation, popular among people, especially like these kinds of moments.
Yeah, it's true.
So post for Sandalmajd.
But to be, you know, at the same time, our games have like the category of games we work in. Have high LTV, but low DAU, speaking. It's not
it's like niche games. Well, not niche, but
In terms of audience, it is. But it's lucrative per capita. So it's like in society, in fact, most of the time, nobody knows anything about the game you do. And it's awkward.
It's awkward because
you're a significant player. A significant industry player.
Yeah, shareholder.
Yeah, but like you go around the compound, the garden, the restaurant.
Yeah,
nobody knows your game.
You're not.
Because it's as you said, it's a niche audience.
It's been happening to us, by the way, lately with one of our games. Like once I was in Egypt and someone asked me what do you do. I told them. They told me, oh, there's this game. It was like, yeah, that's our game. It was a really nice
to be seen. Yeah, it's nice to see.
Yeah.
By the way, recently at passport control, also I had the opposite reaction. Again, the policeman, the border police, like the passport control gentleman, was asking me what I do, and I told him I make games. And he's like, so you're the one ruining my kids.
I had to apologize.
I didn't even know which game he meant. Probably not one of ours. We don't ruin generations.
You know, actually, it's nice that we touched on this, because one of the goals behind this podcast was actually to see who are the people building these types of games, or like whoever is entertaining us. Yeah, anyway, Falafel, you for Sandalmajd, post that you told me you developed several games.
Yeah, about five mid-core games, strategy RPG.
Mm-hmm.
Then we moved on to mobile. And
so it was five games before mobile?
No. Sorry. These were like mainly mobile. So we moved on to mobile first and then mobile only. That's over the years up until...
And you changed engines, of course, and you had to adapt.
Yeah. Actually, yeah. Cocos was hot in China. Cocos to the X.
Mm.
So that's what we were using.
At the time.
Yeah.
Interesting. And how did this transition happen between Falafel and Nifty Craft?
So Nifty Craft, targets global audiences.
Okay.
And we feel over the years that we did not want to be constrained by 1% of the overall market. One. And two, and most importantly, is that we feel that the dynamic of the market changed from a regional competition to a global competition, no matter what you do, because of like the way distribution is handled and access of users happens. So I'll explain to you what I mean here. Before the dominance of the mobile platforms, the Play Store, the App Store, the stores, a lot of games were accessed via regional channels. So like you would, a kid in Saudi would go to google.com.sa, local search engine, enter Al'ab, which is
games
for a keyword for in Arabic. But, you know, so it's a local word and get 10 results, two of which are relevant. One of which is ours, 50% market share. But with the dominance of App Store, Play Store, but also
Steam, Facebook and
Sony.
I think it's more on the, it's also on the distribution side, more than availability.
Yeah, right. Also on the,
if it wasn't for Facebook, hyper casual wouldn't be a thing.
Yeah. Also on the, like the way ads are managed. So it just, you know, like, so that same kid now has access to 10,000 games from everywhere, from Vietnam, Finland, UK, US, China, whatever. And you can't anymore stand out via the distribution channels. So you just have to stand out, in, you know, via the ad networks, the global ad networks, and the and the storefronts, the stores. So it became a global, and you then you had to find a global angle of attack. So do you, instead, you know, maybe there are still some categories and genres where you can do a geographic plays, but by and large, I think it's like insights related to a certain category, certain genre, certain user behavior, certain communities that are global. So it was mainly like the market change and our ambition. And we wanted to, like with Nifty Craft, we also tried to be very much have a vision beyond just game content. So what do you build when your game is no more? We've gone through a lot of large games that, with Falafel games, that go through a sunrise and a sunset. A sun, and then, you know, like the game dies and what are you left with? So as I told you earlier with Nifty Craft, we're building a platform for, you know, to via a web hub for many other games to plug in.
This is the economies.
That's, yeah, I know, but also for other games, you know, that's like
a
new kind of concept. And the benefit of like many games, you know, having their items have benefits in each other. Is actually mainly from what we've seen from the potential partners is mainly UA. If you have a Guardian helmet in your game and I want to attract the holders of a Guardian helmet to my game, which is, I don't know, racing, you know, and I'll give them I'll give them special wheels, tires in my game. So I can give them those things and then I'll add benefits in my game. Then I'll attract them. So you kind of disintermediate the middleman, the UA middleman. But also you boost LTV.
It's like affiliate stuff.
It's, so let me tell you how it started.
Okay.
You know, like now for sometimes Riot releases items in their battle pass of League of Legends, for example, that you can actually use in TFT. We used to do that. It's not rocket science. I mean, most companies do it. And so we used to do it with our user having an item with benefits in many games of ours. Power users only care about that. So the power users, they came to us and they asked to give them items that they can use in other games that we don't even own, some we don't even know of.
Yeah.
And we said, they're so naive. We're going to do business development. And you know, problem in parity and conversions technically will not work.
The hassle.
Do we really want to do this? I mean, every developer wants to keep their LTV to themselves, their audience to themselves.
So I guess
these guys are naive. And although I had been myself in Bitcoin since 2013, and I had helped a few friends with their craze of ICOs in 2017, I had never thought of using the blockchain for games. And they came to me, yeah, but you know, you can use, apparently there's
a new technology.
Yeah, called blockchain, and we can own our items ourselves and use it anywhere we want. And ping, a light bulb lit in my mind. I was like, that's true. It's not as simple as that, because you need to carry, I mean, it's a bundle of data that needs to have a meaning across games. And you know, game designers are very jealous. Game economies are about their game.
I still don't get it, by the way. Even though I understand the whole concept, but visually, how would it appear?
It doesn't have to be visual. So it's that bundle of data. It's a benefit that you...
Yeah, I mean, if these guys, for example, the ones that, like you were talking about, they wanted to have this item in a different game.
Yeah.
How would that item appear? Apart from damage points and attack and whatever.
Yeah, it can buff a stat.
Oh, okay.
It can be a cosmetic. It can...
Yeah, if it was a cosmetic.
The game importing that item, at least in the way we're doing it now, decides what to attribute
the user
that item in their
okay.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, it's a bid. It's kind of like a bid. Okay, you have a Guardian helmet in that game. You know what? I'll offer you 2 gems in my game if you come in. You come, you deposit your Guardian helmet, you get 2 gems, and you can use the 2 gems. Not enough people are coming. Okay, I'll give you now 2 gems.
And yeah, value versus...
And a sword. No, I'll give you 2 gems, a sword, and $1. You know, so it's kind of like the bids of the
ad networks. Yeah. And it's cross-promotion.
Among all third parties.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Bypassing the distributors, the traditional distributors, maybe.
Yeah,
not bypassing, but...
Yeah, and if you think about it, but also on the LTV side, it's harder to explain that it boosts LTV. At least that's what I saw when we talked to potential, you know, partners joining that hub. But at least we'll see. The jury is way out there, but it should boost LTV. Why?
How can you measure the LTV boost?
Different paradigm. But we'll see what it is. But it's definitely a different paradigm. The how to measure the game's GDP.
Yeah, because you need this to get more partners.
Yeah, because now your LTV that you earn, you earn it fully based on the fact that your item and your player is still in your own economy. But now you have an item that's flowing between economies. I think maybe instead of looking at it as like the value that you're getting is the sum of LTVs of players, maybe the value that you're getting is the sum of utilities of items. Whatever. I don't know. I'm speculating.
Yeah, but
actually, I have to think about this.
Yeah, but the thing I meant for LTV is that how much does your system increase a new third-party developer's LTV if they integrate with your system? It's not the other way around.
Say again.
Let's say I have a game and then I have these 5 items and you approach me. Give me these 5 items, put them in my game, and I will increase your LTV by X percent instead of increasing the LTV for the existing game in your ecosystem. I'm not sure if it's clear. I think there are 2 sides of the one, the games that are supplying and the others that are receiving.
Yeah.
2 different LTVs even, right?
Yeah, of course. Of course. So, but what I meant by boosting LTV is for the supplier. So... If now you're grinding for a sword or you're buying a sword or a hybrid of these 2 things in my game, yeah, so it will have utility for you in my game. And you're really loyal to my game and you don't worry about using it elsewhere. Probably most players won't worry so much about using it elsewhere. Really, how many wanna play so many? But if you know that you can have its benefit, it can still carry benefits elsewhere. You will attach more value to it. Today, games are like, you're buying a furnished apartment or renting, buying a furnished apartment, but you're not allowed to move your furniture elsewhere when you buy it, when you go to a new apartment. Yes. That's how games are today. Yes. So the value of that apartment is less as compared to when you can actually move your furniture.
Mm.
There's we live in like a global economy where countries do not trade. So every country has to like dig their own oil, do their own manufacturing, build their own autos, do the transport, everything, and not trade. So I think it's, you know, it's a very rudimentary state of affairs we're in. Now, does it mean, this is an analogy I'm giving you, it's a metaphor. Does it mean, oh, games have to trade and be like the global economy? I definitely hope so, but yeah, we'll see how it will go.
Interesting. Okay, so you told me you're planning to launch in the beta in June.
Yeah.
And the full launch in August. Is the game available today? Can we see any type of footage from that game? Yeah. Can you like?
So it's on Steam.
Okay.
It's cannot download it on Steam, but you can download a demo.
Okay.
Steam already. We're participating in Steam Next Fest. And yeah, you can see footage. You want to see it?
Now? Yeah, please.
Yeah. So you're basically what you. It's a hybrid between deck builder and MMO. So it's a deck builder wrapped by an MMO meta, where every item with a player-driven economy.
Okay.
Where every item is crafted by the players, and every resource to craft these items is gathered by the players. To create as much as with and the PvP and the PvE trash and damage items, so that creates sinks, so that you know you need the time to gather becomes valuable again to drive the. So we don't create items, we don't create resources. The battle is like a Pokemon. You know, you're in the open world, you find another player, you catch him. Well, mm-hmm. Pokemon find a monster PvE only, but we have PvE, VP, solo and group. You can, for example, you can join a monster against a player, you can join a player against a monster, and it's all like open in the open world. It's 2D, it's joyful colors. That's why it's kind of attracting a larger proportion of females as we'd expected. And the gear, it's classless. You put the gear, you know, you can have a mage hat with soldier armor and leather boots, hunter boots. And it's your build that allows you, defines what deck and what abilities you can deploy in battle. And those abilities are learned abilities that you have to also get as XP, as reward as you go.
Interesting. And these items that I craft, these are the items that I can port to other games?
We haven't decided which ones specifically can be carried over, but... these would be the ones that make more sense to take and bring. It's they are, they are very core to our game. They are the items that have that would probably be traded the most inside of the game, and they impact your performance the most. And so you have to like craft high level gear, which will be expensive.
What should we expect in the beta version? Beta version.
You'll have all this. It's just like early on without much monetization, you know, optimizing against playtime, retention, experience, squashing the bugs.
Okay, cool. So this is from the development side.
Mm.
Now, I also today when I was looking at your LinkedIn to try to to get more information.
Someone looks at it. That's good. That's a promise. It's exciting. I'm happy someone looked at my...
You're a venture partner with MEVP. Could you please like tell me more about what you...
So MEVP was my first check with... One of my first checks with Falafel Games.
Okay.
And again, one of my first checks in Nifty. So... Belot et Rebelot, they're quite, we have a relationship full of trust.
Mm-hmm.
It's lucky also. Because of that long-term relationship and, you know, friendship with their partners, I help them with occasionally review, you know, getting deals. I get deals that I send their way, but also reviewing some deals in the domains I kind of sometimes they send me things in domains I don't understand. I don't know why.
Do you give your feedback?
With a grain of salt. I gotta do your job. But yeah, I tell them. Sometimes no, things I get.
Interesting. Because now that you've seen the... Have you actually, while you were at MVP, have you actually done any gaming deal? No.
I've seen MVP do, if you remember, fuel-powered, a platform for multi... So it was founded by the founder of CryptoKitties. Or one of the founders, who moved on to Dapper Labs. So they were also an investor in that, in his previous startup, the multiplayer, like a tool to enable multiplayer in casual games. Fuel, I think it was called. They had an investment in a long time ago in a small studio.
Okay, now you've seen the industry from a developer perspective, and you've seen it from a kind of VC perspective as well.
Yeah, not so.
I mean, kind of like okay. At least overseeing these and knowing what's happening and the at least the decision making behind. Deals and how they're done.
Yeah.
And you've seen the industry in China, you've seen it in the region. How would you compare the region today in terms of like from the business of gaming perspective to other regions? I'm not sure if you're still if you're still active in the Chinese ecosystem, but how would you compare this to other regions, maybe Europe, maybe North America, maybe Southeast Asia? And what, in your opinion, is... I know there's no recipe for success, but what, in your opinion, is required from us as players in this region and from investors, from an ecosystem by itself, for us to become a gaming hub as most countries are trying to do here in the region? Yeah, it's a long question, but...
Whatever I answer, don't hold me accountable for it.
No, it's I'm trying sure. to pick your mind on this.
Yeah. No, I think so. First of all, status quo compared to other places, quite behind in terms of sophistication, in terms of number of successes, in terms of scale, in terms of talent available. I think that's the core issue.
What does it take to succeed? This is the question.
Luck? I don't know.
as a region.
I think you need liquidity of talent. You need the talent to... But talent cannot also live in a void. So talent needs investment, need companies to sustain them, needs education. So it's like multiple loops of chicken and egg everywhere. It's not like one loop of chicken and egg. It's like you need the talent to have companies, but you need companies to have the talent. And then you need schools to have the talent, and you need talent to be able to give school programs.
Yeah, and the companies, you need investment. And for investors, you need companies.
Yeah. So I think definitely. But at least if you have like talent, it's the input you need for games. That's where you got to start.
Yeah.
I think you invest in education, but you know, from... Like, not a boot camp of 3 weeks. You're competing against... Like, let's say you're a game artist, and any other game artist anywhere would be getting into that profession since they're maybe 12, you know? Not formally, not...
Yeah, as a hobby first, and then...
But yeah, as, like, you know, they see what's going on around them, they learn. They learn something to, you know, when by the time they're in university, maybe they think about it. By the time they graduate, there's someone that may hire them for that skill. So it's not an easy proposition to just like give me a boot camp of 3 days. It's useless.
Yeah, but do you not think there is talent in the region?
There is raw talent. There is raw talent, but it's unequipped. Yeah. So maybe reskilling is a much better proposition than, yeah. So maybe reskilling, you know, like let's say you're good at animation, but you've been, all your life you've been doing animation for TV, for computer graphics.
Yeah.
Now you can, but it's not a plug and play, definitely. And the understanding of how it should be for games, and it's not a copy paste, but at least some reskilling was easier than re-education. But I mean, the region has some countries in the region here, the UAE, Saudi, they have the initiatives, the willingness, the government, you know, the finances to, you know, like fund many chicken to come up with a few eggs, or many eggs to come up with a few chicken. So the education, so also on the investment side, nurture the studios. Eventually what you need is a few proximate role model, proximate successes. And instead of keeping things fluid and vague and wide, you know, just find a few who you can really make success of. Some success. Oh.
Yeah, there doesn't have to be like a huge success.
No, no. But then, you know, some mom sitting here in the neighborhood would look at the neighbor like, yeah, see, that guy's making money from playing games, from making games, or from working something game-related. You know, you don't really have to like be a doctor or an engineer.
Like, at least you're making a living from yeah. the gaming.
So some people have to start making a living out of that. And some, I mean, if you simplify your first milestone to having some amount of people making a living from the game industry, be a UA.
But we're there.
UA manager. We're way behind.
We're behind as opposed to other regions, but I mean in the sense of people making their living from the games industry.
Yeah, you're behind.
Yeah, but we are actually making a living from the game industry. I mean, I think
we're well off, and we need to be more successful.
Definitely. This is why I'm asking. What does it take to be more successful?
Maybe if I were the government, I would look at like the 10 most successful teams around me and make them even more successful. As a shortcut. I would still have to invest in education. I would still have like facilitate investment. The private sector here is eager.
I wanted to ask you about this because last time you posted on LinkedIn that in your opinion, an advantage for Dubai is having it has a good private sector. I think.
I mean, no. What I said is the government relies on shaking the private sector to get things moving.
Okay.
But it has a healthy ecosystem of investors. I mean, in general, they invest in warehouses, maybe. But I mean, there is regulation for that. There is investor protection here too, Abu Dhabi.
Yeah. You were saying about the private sector.
So, yeah, so to motivate the private sector, you don't just say, hey, guys, it's interesting to invest in games. You put your money, you're the investor, you're the government, you're the taxpayer.
Yeah.
Okay? Even not the tax, the public money. At least put your money first and take it last. So the private sector starts to get rolling by putting, so the private sector puts their money after you. Lead the way. Don't ask them to lead the way and you lead the other way, no one's going to do what you say, you know? I think, you know, putting your money first on the investment side, let the government put their money first in a fund or something, or a matching program. I don't know. I don't know the actual mechanic, but put the money first so the private sector follows, and let the private sector earn their money first, and then you take your money out, and then you're going to have some wheel going. On the investment side, still need education, means everything.
Yeah.
But the good thing about gaming is, like, maybe 500 people working in gaming are worth, you know, with all due respect, 5,000, well, just as an example, people working in manufacturing.
You mean in terms of skills? Yeah, like,
in terms of externalities, you know, like you would go to, you would rent out,
sorry,
you would earn more, you would spend more per capita.
Mm.
You don't need an investment to make intellectual property. You just sit on your laptop and you make intellectual.
So in terms of effect on the GDP, you mean? Or
so if you look at, yeah, I see what you mean. If you look at it, yes. So I'm not an economist, but just from what I understand from, you know, the impact on GDP, if I think if, you know, you get 1% of GDP coming from trade is much less than 1% of GDP, is much less valuable than 1% of GDP coming from with trade. You need
how many people?
Huge input, you know, to get that business going. A lot of investments and inventories and input. Well, in game, you get it by having people. And people are there. Like it.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned education several times. What do you mean by education? Like, because as far as I know, there is some good level education also in gaming.
Not really?
Yeah, there are some programs. I mean, like university programs in gaming. But even if it's not in gaming, like if we talk about art, it's you have, I think, very good degrees in architecture, for example, or in design. Also for development, you have great degrees in programming. So it doesn't have to be like a focused gaming program as much as it has to be the basic skill. And the basic skills are there.
Yeah, you have some places with good basic skills. Brain drain takes them away.
Yeah.
Assuming, you know, like looking at those who don't get brain drain, I still think they need to be reskilled. I mean, you talk to me about
reskilling
fine arts
is
and
fine.
Architecture. This is not gaming.
Yeah.
You know, so they need reskilling. But then you need the industry to desire them to be reskilled and to afford that. And the industry is still not there.
Yeah.
So why would they reskill? You know, they would still make better earning if they income if they work in architecture. But yeah, I mean, maybe at the raw level, the education institutions can tell you we're doing what we can do. You know, the rest is on the industry. It's possible.
Yeah.
But what I was alluding to more is the need for almost like culture instead of education. It's a long-term thing. It takes really long time for you
definitely
to be a good game artist. You don't get it in 3 days and 4 days.
Definitely.
And if you ask me what to do, and the government you're saying, or you know, the higher-ups are willing to do something, definitely don't do a 3 days boot camp. Think about how you can, you know, bake this talent over a very long period of time. Maybe a slow burn even. You don't have to put them in a military program, formal program for games since they're seven. But anything that's needed to be able to be in games or creative industries from young age and the exposure should be available. And I don't feel it's there.
Yeah, you don't feel it's there. I agree with that. But at the same time, we've been operating for a while now. Like, you've been doing this since 16 years ago, more or less. And other studios that I know, they've been operating for the past like 10 years. I myself have been operating for like 7-8 years now. We're not looking for shortcuts. We're there. We're still operating. We're in the market. We've had a few successes, small successes. But you still feel that there's a certain lack. In some countries, you can see that things are better than in others.
Yeah.
But we're still...
In talent, like Jordan, Lebanon, Egypt.
Yeah, exactly. Jordan, Lebanon, Egypt, even in Tunisia. In gaming, I mean. Yeah, in gaming. There are companies. There is talent. You can find talent. There are gaming artists that have been operating for like 10 years now. Like you have what it takes. What do you think for such countries I mean, as a mix-up, like knowing that in this region we have countries with good talent and then in other countries with good policies at least, and good business infrastructure. What are we waiting for, in your opinion?
For what?
Like, people are looking at MENA as the upcoming gaming hub or upcoming...
Who's looking at MENA?
I mean, if you feed the news.
They're looking at MENA as a source of money, man.
Yeah, I'm not...
The game investors coming in, they come raising money. The studios coming in, they come to be sold to acquirers here or to raise money. I don't think truly they're like looking at the region and thinking, we want to have a studio here. I don't think so. The good Russian, some good Russian studios did move here because of the whole sanctions situation. So Cyprus, then here. Well, that's because they didn't have many options.
If you were a policymaker, where would you start?
All this. Education investment. Yeah.
Okay, interesting. Cool. What's the next step for you?
So, tunnel vision towards releasing the game and then building the hub, you know, the
back platform on top of the interoperability. Game.
Yeah. And we're also going to go to a lot of things. So all the libraries that we've built over the years that help us develop like the meta function, the meta loops function of the game, crafting, spawning, farming, trashing, damaging, selling, buying, leveling up, leveling down, whatever. We will also package them and offer them to the market soon. So it'll be like an MMO as a service kind of middleware or a strategy game as a service kind of middleware. We've had all this technology for a long time, as a team for a long time.
Yeah, I remember you told me that.
Yeah. But it was like a car with three wheels, you know, and you need to use it for your own game. So you just like personalize it, customize it, and then patch it up, and it works. Now we just like want to put a fourth wheel, give it a paint job, put a bow tie on it, and offer it. So it makes our tools better, which helps us make our games better. And yeah.
But that helps you also
accelerate development.
Exactly. And make some revenues at the same time for you guys. Interesting. Where do you see the industry evolving? I mean, at least from a PC, since you're building a PC game.
Well, we're PC first, then browser. I would like it to be on the browser and then on scale on mobile.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. Definitely. PC just appeared to be like a good, the most democratic platform. Place where you can, it's a place where players are more forgiving when you come and tell them, I'm still building this game.
It's not a finished product.
Though their end expectations are much higher, but they are happy to co-produce.
They're more patient for the PC game.
Definitely. They want to take part in the building also. And you can get some early communities. You go to Reddit, you go to streamers, you get early communities. On mobile, you get zero downloads.
Yeah.
If you follow that route, you have to do the...
Mobile is
the UA playbook. Yeah. But it's tough to know, man, where it's going. I mean, it's just such a big market with so many genres, so many ecosystems.
Yeah. At least in MENA, for example.
In the region, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's going to get better. More talent, more investments, more successes. I'm just not sure if it will be... if it will just stay behind. I mean, if it moves at the same speed as anywhere else, it's going to stay behind, it must move much faster. I'm not sure if it will move faster or not. Don't you think spray and pray is a better strategy? I mean, in terms of if you want to move faster.
Yeah, why not? Yeah, I mean, there definitely must be a lot of conscious experimentation. Do the 3 days boot camps, invest in unknown teams, invest, try to bring teams in, invest out, abroad, put money for before the private sector. Don't put money. Yeah, do everything you can do. As long as you do it consciously and you know that it's not like you're just doing, you're just spraying and without measuring your results.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think...
I mean, but that's the VC model as well.
The region here has the capacity to...
Exactly, this is spray and pray.
Yes.
It's also the VC model. You invest in 10 companies.
Ah, you mean...
So maybe, you know, anchor VCs that want to focus on gaming, but as long as there's a private partner in it.
Okay, for people who might be watching us from out of the region and are asking questions.
By the way, celebrate successes. So if the successes are moderate, celebrate them, because what you want is you want the talented people and their parents to believe that you can earn an income.
You mean attention? Maybe media attention to the studios. Yeah, I mean, for people who are watching us from out of the region that are interested in the MENA region, like hearing or reading about the news, where would you put us as a... at what stage do you put us now? I mean, for example, let's say today there's a VC or there's a big publisher or big studio that is looking at the region for a potential market. Where would you position us for them to understand... Like the roadmap.
No, the good teams here are world class. I think the good teams here are underrated. They are definitely world class. They're just living in a vacuum. And they're underrated. I truly believe that. And what I was trying to say earlier is that there isn't enough of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they don't have a very healthy environment around them. They are a
Yeah, we're building the ecosystem of a healthy environment. We are trying to do it.
Yeah, but I also think in my mind, you know, I mean, I was probably one of the very first people making games for Arabic speakers and thinking about the region. And when I moved on, the region started waking up and like getting interested in this. And now that train is long gone. Yeah. And yet, I'm telling you, let each team of us, let each studio or whatever game-related company is out there, try to do the best they can without having necessarily to frame their whole being as part of the MENA.
I wanted to ask, do you see value today in building Arabic games? I mean, not for you. I mean, in general, building Arabic games or for the studios from out of, from abroad that are looking into the region, do you think they should localize their content or just launch their games normally without even localizing? Like, by localizing, I mean mostly Arabizing.
I think definitely they should not make it exclusively, except in specific genres, but in general.
Mm.
Genres like trivia, word, it has to be exclusively for that language. But in general, just make a good world-class game. And then if you see that it has potential in the region, definitely culturalize. Definitely insert local elements without having to change it all. Yeah,
cool.
And your live ops and your content plan, introduce. Definitely, introduce.
Do not theme it as Arabic.
Fully.
No, exactly.
Fully. So there is space for fully themed. I realize that you're just going after this market. And in my mind, it only works in specific genres.
Yeah, and manage your expectations if you're going after this specific.
Yeah, yeah.
So the question comes here. If we have some people interested in getting into the industry or starting their own studios, what advice would you give them if they're from this region? How to start or like any type of advice that could be super beneficial for someone starting today in you?
I think the same as in any region. I mean,
I don't think there's something that should stand out for starting a studio or a business here or anywhere. I mean, I know the environment here is harder. But it doesn't change, you know, what you do as a startup. I mean, why are you doing this business?
I've seen lots
of... Why are you working it with these co-founders? Are you a good fit? Do you have a vision beyond just making a cool game that you think is going to be the...
Yeah, exactly. This is why I'm asking. I mean...
But that's anywhere.
Yeah, but even here in the region, I've seen lots of studios that are focusing on Arabic games, Arabic content, which I know there's a market for that. But at some point, it will become like most studios are trying to create Arabic games, you know? That's why I was just asking, like, for when you started, what do you know today, or what did you realize today that you didn't when you started? I mean, it's a big
thing. Yeah, it just keeps changing. Everything keeps changing, man.
Something stupid like that. Something that hits you still until today.
You know, I think sometimes ignorance is bliss. So when I think about all the risks I was actually taking when I first started in gaming, I wouldn't do it again.
Be foolish.
But I was foolish by mistake. I just didn't know what I didn't know. And so the game we were building was massive. Just make it 5 months, guys. Go finish the game and let's get going.
Me too. If I know what I know today, I wouldn't start.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So... But how do I translate this into an advice to someone who wants to start?
It's not easy.
Yeah.
I mean, I would tell them to listen for advice, but at the same time, do what they feel is right and filter the advice.
Yeah. You know? Maybe you should just ask question. Why are you doing it? Why are you doing it with that guy or that girl? What are you building beyond that stupid game that's going to fail? What's your second game? Because your first game is going to fail.
Exactly. What's your second? If this is smart, what's your second game?
Yeah.
Because the first one
was definitely... And in that is your... So ask questions, I guess. Because you cannot tell them, hey, your second game should be built on the experience that you have built.
But
BS.
Pick their mind about... to understand how they're actually...
Yeah, poke their mind.
Yeah, poke their mind.
Maybe. And if they have good answers, then it looks like a good team. But sometimes they can, you know, be building a live service that's gonna survive 50 years, but like, what is the second version of that, like, whatever, how does it look like in a year or in 2 years from 2 years from now? And so are they thinking through, are they maintaining a thread of strength from one game to the next, or from one version to the next? It means fundamentally they probably have a good vision and a good understanding of their core, but if they're just like bouncing around from cool game to cool game.
Are you seeing this in the studios that you're helping today?
Yeah, mostly.
Yeah.
It's not easy, man. Even us. I mean, we sometimes.
Yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, a lot of times, you know, like, you find the great teams who, for $500,000, want to compete with PUBG. Yeah. Okay. And then they give you examples of outliers, you know, so they, and they think they will, like, follow the outliers. So it's good to be ignorant to do it. You know, if you're wise, if you're not wise, if you're more mature, if you're like battle scarred, you'll not do it, and then nobody's gonna do anything.
You have to believe that you will follow the outliers in order to make something good, at least our average.
That's why I was saying earlier, you need proximate role models. So the proximate role models, I think, and if you're like aware enough, awakened enough, you look at them and it gives you a sense of like the very next step, not like the next month, the 12 months, the 24 months from now, the reality in this environment, not the platitudes that I hear that Steve Jobs says.
One time wonder.
Written on a wall and some incubator and, you know.
Yeah.
Okay.
The big successes that are far away, it's actually very hard to grasp how they operate internally, how they think, how they do their decisions. You see the game. The game tells you nothing. Are they 600 people or 6 people?
Yeah.
Some copycats don't know. Why are you a copycat? How are you differentiating? Are you going to like produce massive live ops, massive content every day? You know, is it, you know, like, how are you managing the battle pass? How are you making decisions? What kind of culture are you building? No clue. But we're making a PUBG clone. Yeah, you see a lot of these.
Yeah, but lots of studios are actually succeeding this way.
Maybe they have secrets. Maybe they have strengths inside them. Mm-hmm. Maybe the ones.
Yeah, maybe. I've always been intrigued to know.
So for people who are looking to get in touch with you, where would they follow actually your work? Where are you mostly active?
Wishlist on Steam. Well, it doesn't have to wishlist because we're live service. I mean, free live service anyways. But yeah, I think LinkedIn. LinkedIn is good.
LinkedIn. And for those people who are interested to play the beta and the
Steam. Steam or their own landing page.
Ah, so do you have like a...
Yeah, with Discord and...
Okay, cool. I think that's it. It was a real pleasure having you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thank you.